On the Grindhouse Girls podcast, we discuss all things spoopy, scary, and strange. Some content may be disturbing or graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, Grindhouse Girls friends and fam. Danish filmmaker Lars von Trier is used to controversy, from being banned from Cannes Film Festival for a year, to animal cruelty during the filming of his 2005 film Manderley, to recurring motifs of graphic sex, violence, and sexual violence in his filmography, to name a few. Lars's film career has created shockwaves since the very beginning. But whether you consider him an enfant terrible or an absolute genius, if you love film, you know his name. Caroline Bainbridge, author of The Cinema of Lars von Trier, pointed out that Lars began to focus more intensely on women in the 90s. Then, in the 2000s, there came Antichrist.
Written in 2006, while hospitalized for depression, Antichrist was created as a form of catharsis for Lars. He claimed he made the film for himself, and at the time of its release in 2009, he said it was the most important movie of his career. It would go on to premiere at Cannes Film Festival, where lead actress Charlotte Gainsbourg would go on to win the Best Actress Award for her performance. But the film itself would generate polarizing reviews as well as deep discussions of its themes and materials even 15 years after its release. So, here's a question. What are you most afraid of? Join us tonight as we let chaos reign. This is the Grindhouse Girls podcast. Hey, this is Katie, and I'm so sorry I triggered you with this movie.
Hi, I'm Brittany.
Were you triggered, Brittany? You've seen it before, so maybe not.
No. Not really. Thank God. Once I was like, oh wait, fuck. Here's the deer coming up, because I do remember.
It's awful.
Yeah, I do. I was like, okay. So, pardon me, girls. Brian, I'm sorry, girls. Okay.
Speaking of deers. Okay. Brittany's
I was about to say,
giant deers are crying.
But yeah, the thing with von Trier is, like, I was like, oh shit, I forgot about the three beggars in this movie. Yeah. And so naturally, despite all the graphic sexual violence, as soon as the movie was over, I was like, fuck, I need to, like, research about, there was a triggering scene to me. Okay, this movie's full of triggers. So we'll just get triggers. That out of the way. So many triggers. But there's a scene where, like, a baby bird falls out of a nest.
Yeah.
Ants scatter all over it. And then a hawk picks it up and rips off its wing and starts eating it. I could not find anywhere confirming that was CGI. And I did find confirmation that Lars likes to use a lot of real documentary subject in his films. So I think that may actually be real. Now, the argument for the three beggars is, like, technically we know for sure the fox is CGI. But they said, like, with the deer, that it could be, that technically the deer was CGI, but it could be made from a real image.
I watched this movie twice on Criterion. It's on Criterion and Tubi right now.
Oh, and AMC Plus. What Criterion's
for? Okay. AMC Plus. So there's two versions available on Criterion. There's the plain watching the movie version, and there's one with commentary with Lars von Trier and a film critic. I forgot to write the film critic's name on there, but there's commentary and Lars von Trier is talking on it, and the deer scene came up. I was listening to it today because honestly, like, they don't really let you hear any of the movie, they're talking about the whole time, so I just kind of, like, put the video away and just listened to it while I worked today. And he said that the deer thing was real, but it was not hurting the deer. So I'm assuming that it was a fake fetus and a real deer. But they also had puppetry, because in the credits it says puppets by. So a lot of the animal stuff was puppets, But he also used real animals too. But I don't think, I mean, obviously they didn't disembowel a fox, I believe.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And the crow, I think, was the puppet, probably. Yeah,
so there was, I think the fox was a puppet at times and also CGI. So there is CGI in this movie, but a lot of it was like to remove stuff. Like in the opening sequence, Nick is wearing a harness, but they removed it digitally. And they also added the teddy bear back in digitally because it was out of the frame when they filmed it. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff. They also, there's like a cornerstone of Lars von Trier's work is like shaky cam and like, and like a very naturalistic improved camera movement, because the thing with him is, okay, so there's this whole thing. If you've never watched Lars von Trier, I've only seen this in Nymphomaniac, but he comes from the Dogma 95.
You brought shaky cam, so I have to go ahead and fucking say it. So in the beginning of the movie, like, you know, him and her are talking, and I hysterically laughed because Katie's right. So this was supposedly, he was originally going to do this whole film, like, via handheld, but it was like, he was still recovering from, like, his nerves, and so he didn't. But there's a scene where it's like, she's literally just like, you didn't, like, I forgot exactly what she said, but she's like, you didn't ask about us, you didn't care about us. And it goes to Willem Dafoe, like, he's a character in The Office. Yes. Did you catch that?
Yeah, exactly like that.
I hysterically start laughing.
So I've seen Nymphomaniac parts 1 and 2. Not a big fan. Very much style over substance. And, like, gimmick over substance, I felt like. But, like, beautifully, like, shot film. So I was like, maybe I'll like Antichrist. I can't say I like Antichrist, but I understand more of Antichrist. And I think it has more of a purpose. Because it is, Antichrist, if you haven't seen it yet, it is a treatise on anxiety and depression. It is not supposed to be taken literally. It is supposed to be symbolic and metaphorical. However, the first time I watched it, I didn't really know that. And I watched it and I was like, wow, this is awful. And then, like, I watched it with the commentary and I started thinking about it and I was like, I guess if I think about it as a metaphor, it's a lot easier to swallow and digest. But I did go down the Dogma 95 manifesto rabbit hole because I didn't know about that, and it explains a lot about his filmmaking. Now, this movie doesn't have all the 10 rules of it, but it has a lot of them. And so I thought I'd just read it as kind of like a fun little thing. So basically in Denmark, where he is from, there was a group of filmmakers who made the Dogma 95 list of rules. And it was basically a rejection of traditional filmmaking. And they were trying to be like anti-filmmaking filmmakers. And it was in 1995. And they all had to take a quote-unquote vow of chastity, which is just being chaste to filmmaking. And the vow of chastity is, furthermore, I swear as a director to refrain from personal taste. I am no longer an artist. I swear to refrain from creating a, quote, work, as I regard the instant as more important than the whole. My supreme goal is to force the truth out of my characters and settings. I swear to do so by all the means available and at the cost of any good taste and any aesthetic considerations. Thus, I make my, in all caps, vow of chastity. So they have this little vow, and they're all going to make films like this. And he did attempt to make, like, 3 films like this, but he kind of started breaking the rules. And the rules are, shooting must be done on location. Props and it was all part of rule 1. Props and sets must not be brought in. If a particular prop is necessary for the story, a location must be chosen where this prop is to be found. That's weird. Number 2, the sound must never be produced apart from the images or vice versa. Music must not be used unless it occurs where the scene is being shot. Obviously, he didn't. He broke that rule. The camera must be handheld. Rule number 3. Any movement or immobility attainable in the hand is permitted. Number 4. The film must be in color. Special lighting is not acceptable. This movie breaks that rule. Number 5. Optical work and filters are forbidden. Which I will say, there's a lot of natural lighting in this movie. But there's also sequences in black and white, which obviously doesn't completely agree with that. Number 6 is the film must not contain superficial action. Murders, weapons, etc. must not occur. Obviously, that is out the window for this one. Temporal and geographical alienation are forbidden. That is to say, the film must take place here and now. Genre movies are not acceptable. The film format must be Academy 35mm. And the director must not be credited. Which obviously is broken. So, like,
yeah,
he still attains some of that stuff. He also is very famous for having weird jump cuts where they don't need to be. Because usually a jump cut is, like, someone's doing, like, talking for hours and hours. So you do a jump cut to them, like, 10 minutes later, 30 minutes later. But, like, instead he'll do jump cuts and not cut the audio. So it's just a continuation of the scene with a jump cut for no real reason. He does that a lot. That's kind of a hallmark of his filmmaking. And a lot of, like, close-ups. A lot of just in-your-face handheld camera work. And it's interesting. Like, it is like a style. And he is a good, technically good filmmaker, I think. But his ideas are kind of just, like, he likes to make people squirm. And he finds it hilarious when people are offended by his films. And he says he has a very dark sense of humor. And that is just kind of his thing. He's also kind of a weird person. I don't know. Did you get into, like, all the weird shit he has said, Britt?
Yeah. So, yeah. It, to me, feels like he's a little bit of a troll at times. Like, it's like walks a very fine line between being, like, a torture genius and a troll. Mm-hmm. And something that I thought... So, I've read quite a few articles, but there was an article from NPR called Lars von Trier, A Problematic Sort of Ladies Man.
Yeah.
And so you can read in his Wikipedia, like, that basically his mother told him on her deathbed that his father wasn't really his father. Uh-huh. And something that he says, he's like, yeah, I set out to make... I thought this was, like, both awful and kind of hilarious. He's like, yeah, every movie I set out, I kind of want to make sure that it was a movie my mom would hate. And they're like, do you think your mom would have hated Melancholia? He's like, no, it's probably why I don't like that one that much.
Well, also, you know? He's no longer welcome at Con because at Melancholia... And I watched... Okay, this is on YouTube.
I thought they lifted it after a year. They lifted it after a year.
Because he was persona non grata for a little while. So, mm-hmm. At Con...
Yeah.
He's also that person that thinks he's funny, but, like, he doesn't tell you... He tells you point A, and then he goes straight to point E, and doesn't tell you B, yeah. C, D. So, like, in his head, it's funny... To say, he literally said, I understand Hitler now. And people are like, what? And then he's like, I guess I'm a Nazi. And he's like laughing. Kirsten Dunst is sitting next to him during this entire press conference. It is on YouTube. You can watch it. It is top tier cringe. Because he just keeps digging the hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And he isn't a Nazi. But he... was saying that, I guess the guy he thought it was his dad is Jewish, and he grew up thinking he was Jewish, but he doesn't say, because I thought my dad was a different person, he just says, I thought I was Jewish, and then I found out I was German, and then, I wouldn't have even been a cool Jewish person, because, like, there's tiers of Judaism, and I was just like, what? Oh my god. And then he goes, well, I guess I understand Hitler now, is what he says. And so I was trying to say it so, like, no one can sound clip me saying that, because, like, it's not, I don't understand that. But then he's like, and then he just keeps digging. And Kirsten Dunst looks like she wants to crawl under the table and run away. And she's just like, like, Stellan Skarsgård is like looking at him in the eye. He's just like, you gotta stop now. You gotta shut the fuck up, Lars. And, like, it's so awkward and so weird. Well, and he's in France. Come on, dude.
That was, like, the thing. So, yeah, because I was reading about that controversy, and after a year, they're like, okay, and they let him back. And I think the big thing is that it was, like, Kristen Dunst and I think Charlotte and Stellan, they were just like, yeah, you know, he kind of has, like, they didn't say, like, a bad sense of humor, but they're like, it's his sense of humor, which to me is, like, you know, there's a time and a place. And then Lars was like, yeah, I was, you know, I was kind of under the influence during that interview. But then years later, he was like, yeah, that's the only interview where I was actually sober. So once again, it's like he's kind of, like, trolling. So also, we don't really know what's going on.
Allegedly, he also, like, left his pregnant wife for their much younger babysitter. That was on IMDb. I don't know if that's true. But he also allegedly sexually harassed Bjork during Dancer in the Dark.
And did she? And what's crazy about that, I'm sure you read that too. So he was like, no. He's like, yeah, it wasn't a secret. We didn't like each other. But like, that's what he like, yeah, no, those but allegations aren't true. But he said a bunch of true, shit about yeah, her, like
that she ate a shirt or something. Which is a joke that Katja on RuPaul's Drag Race, she was Bjork for Snatch Game. And it was hilarious. But she started like eating her cards. And like, it was just funny. But then I was like, oh...
But, you know, that's the thing. So I think it was in the NPR article, A Problematic Sort of Lazy Ladies Man, that it also mentioned that, like, during the making of Dogville, him and Nicole Kidman had to go to walks together where they could scream at each other, in front of the rest of the cast and crew.
Like, I wonder why she didn't come back for the second movie.
Right? And that's, like, so for me, and obviously you guys know, like, animals are a big thing of mine, but I'm just like, the fact that they slaughtered the damn donkey for Manderley, that bothers me to no end.
I don't think I'm going
to
be watching that one.
I'm not going to watch Manderley because just reading the plot of it and some of the things I read was a little offensive even before I found out about the donkey thing.
They kind of... So Manderley and Dogville were supposed to be like his American trilogy, which he's never been to America, by the way.
Yeah.
So I love that he has an opinion on America. And
this is... Antichrist is the Depression trilogy. Is the first of those movies for the Depression trilogy.
It's this one, the Nymphomaniac 1 and 2 put together, and then Melancholia. And Manderley like is like basically about slavery. It's about like a bunch of enslaved black people in America who are enslaved because they don't know that the Emancipation Proclamation happened. And it's like decades later, which there was a family. I remember reading this when I was like very young that was found like in the backwoods of Georgia, and they had been working for this family, and like they had just like isolated them, and like they actually I don't know, I can't remember when, but I remember there was a story that it was either they were indentured servants or they were like legitimately still enslaved, and they found out and they were like, oh, well, that's fucking atrocious. But, like...
Yeah, that's awful.
That's kind of what it is. But, like, Bryce Dallas Howard takes over Nicole Kidman's part. I'm not saying she's a bad actress. She's not Nicole Kidman, though. Sorry, Bryce Dallas Howard. She's fine. So, like, you have, like, not as good of a lead. And then... And it's the same character, but she's in a different place. But, like, they kind of have enslavement as a theme. Just not racial enslavement. But that's a theme of Dogville. Two, so I don't know why they needed to do a second movie. I think Lars von Trier just thinks he knows about America and doesn't really understand. But Manderley was such a failure that he hasn't done the third one, which I think is supposed to be called Washington. So I don't know if we're ever getting that trilogy.
I also have to say that it's a very common occurrence for there to be walkouts during the premiere of Lars von Trier's movies. But supposedly, I don't know if this is factual, but supposedly during the house that Jack built, there was over 100 walkouts at that one.
And that one's, I've heard, I've almost watched the movie so many times. I've heard very varying viewpoints of it. Like it's much, like the story itself is much more entertaining. But it is like very gross and disgusting because it is like you're following a serial killer killing people. But it's, like, the thing is, like, he does take interesting things. Like, that follows, like, Dante's Inferno. And then this one has, like, a lot of medieval references, like, the three beggars. And then, like, the Greek, I think it's a Greek myth of the people in the cave. And, no, wait, that's not this one. That's Dog. Oh, hold on. It's not the people in the cave. It's the three beggars. And, like, honestly, the witch trials, Salem witch trials. And all that stuff. And so, like, it's interesting. But, there's a lot of unnecessary violence. And I like grotesque body horror. Some people don't. Like, I love Titan. Titan was one of my favorite movies. I loved Raw. Raw was one of my favorite movies. Like, I enjoyed those. And there was some legitimately... like stomach churning parts, especially raw really churned my stomach when she was eating the chicken cutlet and the thumb. or finger, whatever it was. Like, that part real got me. And that's one of the reasons why that movie stood out to me, was because I was like, most things don't gross me out. This movie, though, it's like, I didn't have fun with the gross out stuff. It was very not fun.
Yeah.
I felt like I wasn't in on the joke, if there was a joke, you know?
Yeah, it's very gratuitous. This is one of those movies I do appreciate symbolism in a movie. I appreciate theme. And this is one of those movies that, like, I love the analysis of it. Yes. Because it's, like, very fascinating when you sit back and analyze the film. A lot of it makes a lot more sense. It's a little bit gratuitous. And I think there is a very fine line between people who think Lars von Trier is gratuitous and then the people who are like, well, there's a meaning for every single shot in every single one of his movies.
I mean, but honestly, listening to his commentary, most of his meanings are like, well, this is about depression. Yeah. I'm like, okay. Which, like, I get it. So the thing is, like, he started writing this in 2006, and then he had a massive mental breakdown, and he had to check into a hospital for a prolonged period because of clinical depression. This was, like, the first movie he did after he got out, and he even says he wasn't 100% mentally there, and he said he relied a lot on Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe. And, like, a lot of their choices are their credit because he just wasn't there mentally. Which, at least he says that. But he also, like, there's also on the Criterion, there's a little, like, video about, like, highlight reel about them at Cannes with this movie. And this guy gets up and says, like, you gotta explain yourself. You need to explain why you presented this movie at Cannes. And instead of being like, he said, explain why you made this movie. And he's like, I don't think I need to. And the guy's like, yes, you do. Because obviously the guy was very offended by the movie. And he's like, well, instead of being like, you know, I'm an artist, it's metaphoric for depression. And if you liked it, awesome. If you didn't, I understand. He goes, well, he basically just goes, well, I think you're my guest at my movie, which isn't true because he's the guest at Cannes filming, like, screening his movie. But then he goes, anyways, I'm the best director in the world. And, like, everyone laughs. And then he's like, okay, and it's the hand of God. And I was just like, or he says, it's the hand of God, and I'm the best director in the world. And I was just like, and I think he's joking. But is he joking?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, he just seems to not really know. I don't know. Maybe he just has social cue issues. I don't know.
I really do think he's a troll. I think that there is, like, a lot of... I think there... His mind goes to some really, really dark places. Oh, yeah. And I think, like, for his filmmaking, he's trying to show us a glimpse into his mind. And in some ways, I imagine that's very cathartic. If you have, like, intrusive thoughts and... You know you would never commit these intrusive thoughts, but you can put them on paper and still put them out there.
Yeah.
Maybe there is something very cathartic at that, if that's what this is. And I think that's what this is.
Well, he also kept saying stuff about, like, this is what marriage is like on the commentary. And I was like, but it was, like, the last 20 minutes. And I was like, wait, what? Oh, no.
You're like,
oh, no, no, no,
oh, no.
No. It's not
No,
good.
I did find to me what is, like, a little bit of the crux of the film, and I guess especially, like, before we essentially, I know we'll go over the characters and go into spoiler alert, but this was from Antichrist, Interview with Lars von Trier, the Electric Sheep magazine, which all of us who know Blade Runner and do Android Stream of Electric Sheep. It said in the film, the characters talk about nature as Satan's church. And he says, connected to the idea that if God had planned to create a place like this where everyone is longing for life, and 99% of everything is dying, then it could be a god. I thought it was such a satanic idea, the whole nature thing, and also that it's a god that invents human beings and then tells them that they're going to die. It's not a very nice god. And the reason I want to go into that is because there seems to be a lot of confusion for people who don't know about Lars von Trier, this movie. They hear the term Antichrist and think it's about the Antichrist, and that's not what it's about at all. So, It's more about how it's the opposite of Christ. That's where the whole crux of the movie, where the whole idea of the movie comes from.
Oh, dang. I missed this. He got diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2022.
Yes, I saw that just very, very recently. Yeah.
And I appreciate avant-garde filmmaking because I think because he's made this movie, I think we get a movie like Hereditary that is, in my opinion, a much better and more complete look at grief.
Yeah.
I don't think this one, I went into this movie thinking it was about grief, and it's really about depression. It's really not about grief. I only got Scott to watch the end of this, and only because I did nod off once. I was watching it after work, which is probably my mistake. I was really tired, and I put on a heated blanket, and me and Gizmo are watching this. Yeah. And then, like, there's all the forest noises, and, like, Scott was like, hey, you need to wake up. And I was like, oh, my God. And so I rewound it, and I watched whatever I missed. But Scott came in the last 20 minutes, and he was like, I'll just tell you this. Scott likes a lot of horror movies, which is, you know, what we first talked about when we met. And he can handle a lot of stuff. But he was like, he closed his eyes for some of it and said, you know what? You can tell everybody 0 out of 10 for me. No. And I was like, well, you didn't see the beginning, but I get it.
Yeah.
I totally get it.
Me and Taylor, even their first time we watched it, we were like, and then you guys can't see my face, but I'm like squinting my eyes.
I was like, no.
The second time we still like kind of did this at the same parts. We were like, like the only thing is that like I have to tell myself prosthetics.
Oh, well, about that, there is a quote from Charlotte Gainsbourg about how some is prosthetics, but basically, this is a bit of a spoiler, but she says, quote, I'm not really a prude, but she was basically asked to jerk off a pornographic actor who was providing the erect penis for a scene, and she goes, quote, I'm not really a prude, but suddenly I felt I was in the wrong film. It wasn't Willem Dafoe. It was this porn actor who was masturbating because he needed his penis erect for the shot. Lars asked me whether we could then do the shot where I smash his genitals with a block of wood. Slight spoiler. But I think everyone knew genital mutilation coming into this movie. So all he needed were my hands. But that was too much for me. I just couldn't do the pornographic scenes. That's my limit. A ridiculous limit when you think of it. ... I don't think it's ridiculous, Charlotte. I think that's perfectly okay. Either. I think she and Willem Dafoe are very brave. They are pantsless for a lot of this movie and butt-ass naked. And it's not enough. I don't think the nudity doesn't really bother me because it makes sense because it's usually just the two of them in a very secluded place. And so, like, it doesn't bother me that they would be naked because they're a married couple who've been married for a while. Doesn't bother me. But I think sex in movies, there's a reason it's simulated most of the time. So
yeah, which is,
I think asking a regular everyday actor to do anything that's an actual sex act or anything on camera, I think that is a huge ask. And he did get it from her in Nymphomaniac, I believe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he does seem to have this theme of, like, torturing his actors. And like, Willem Dafoe basically was like, he was trying to be nice about it, but he was like, how do you get comfortable doing this intimate scenes with someone else? He's like, well, Lars is very tough on us, is what he said. And he was like, so we kind of had to rely on each other because we had to, like, it bonded us, basically. So it does seem like he does torture all his actors, but especially women for some reason. Yeah. It seems like I don't know if he, and it's not like the women seem to be triumphant in a lot of his movies. A lot of them have very dark ends.
Yeah, it seems like the majority of these movies is actually very shattering for women.
Yes.
And as we go into spoilers, we'll talk about this one too and the ramifications of that ending.
Yeah. Are we ready to get into spoilers?
Yeah, I think we are ready to get into spoilers. Spoiler alert for Antichrist, Lars von Trier's Antichrist 2009. Katie, did you write the rundown?
I did write a rundown. The Rundown. A grieving couple travels to their cabin, Eden, to heal themselves and their marriage, but when nature intervenes, things take a disastrous turn.
Dun-dun-dun.
Crash of thunder.
Yeah.
So spoilers after this, because like it's the most fun part about this movie is definitely talking about it. I think we've already talked about the actors, but if you didn't know, just before we get into too spoilery, this movie stars Willem Dafoe as he. None of the characters have names except for their child, Nick. He, who was in The Lighthouse, which we did our first season and we loved. Poor Things recently. Spider-Man. He, too, is a something of a scientist in Spider-Man. And he's also in The Florida Project. Obviously, he famously gets snubbed by the Academy, like, all the fucking time. He didn't get nominated for Poor Things this year.
He's also Jesus in The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, yeah, he's Jesus in The Last Temptation of Christ. And he's
I'm so sorry. William Dafoe's prolific career.
I love him,
our friend Stephanie is screaming about The Boondock Saints because I know she loves that
yes,
movie.
Yes, of course. That's one of my favorite films.
He was also Ryuk in the live-action Death Note, which I still think is hilarious. Vincent Van Gogh in Eternity's Gate, which I also think is phenomenal. And then I didn't realize he collaborated at least twice with Wes Anderson on Asteroid City and The French Dispatch. So, yeah, Willem is like,
and,
you know his face.
The Life Aquatic.
Yeah.
I mean, he's everywhere.
Yeah, you recognize his face instantly.
And he also, like, there's this, like, he will do, like, shitty movies, too. But most of his movies are, like, good choices most of the time. But he's like Nick Cage. I can see him in anything, and I'm entertained.
Yeah.
And he deserves an Academy Award. And then Charlotte Gainsbourg. I keep calling her Gainsborough, but it's Gainsbourg, because there's a painter called Gainsborough. As she, again, no one has a name in this movie. She's actually a composer.
Yeah.
And an actress. Because I didn't realize that until this movie. I was like, what? I didn't know that. So she's in Melancholia, Nymphomaniac, Volume 1 and 2. She's Joe, I believe is the main character's name in that. This really horrible movie we've almost done a few times called The Snowman. It was like edited and everyone says it's terrible. But it has good actors in it, and it's just hilarious. I've watched some of it. It's pretty hilariously bad. And she was also in the movie I'm Not There, which got a lot of Oscar notoriety, because everyone plays Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
It's like a bunch of different people playing Bob Dylan. And Nick is played by Storm. This is a Danish name. Achechi Salstrom, who this is their only credit. So, but they're the only other person. Because everybody else, there are people in the background of some scenes, but all of their faces are blurred. Which is creepy. But, like, it brings the focus to the main characters.
Yeah.
I found that kind of an interesting look. I don't know. What do you want to discuss first?
I don't even know where to begin with this movie. I guess we can, like, maybe give it a little bit of, like, going for the plot kind of quickly, piece by piece, and then, like, we can kind of talk about things as they come up.
Well, let's talk about the opening sequence, because it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's
in all its full penetration glory.
Yeah, I was reading this article. I read a lot. Medium, narrative structure, and the film techniques in Lars von Trier's Antichrist. Mm-hmm. So they said that the opening scene is shot by Anthony Mantle. I can't remember my own damn handwriting. I'm sorry, guys. But they're like, he does it in a way that makes it dignified, but it's kind of like a haunting glamour. And the operatic music is by Handel in the beginning, because you hear like the opera at the beginning and the end. And there's an unsimulated sex shot that Taylor goes, oh yeah, I completely forgot that was in there.
Yeah.
I was
like, It's like you can see them banging in the shower. And then all of a sudden, it's just, like, dick going into vagina in slow-mo. And you're just like, all right, okay. At first, I honestly, like, for a second, I was like, what is going on? I was like, good for them.
A little unnecessary, because we can already tell that they were having shower sex.
Yeah,
so it's like,
it's
have a nice
very
shot.
Unnecessary.
Like, but, guys, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I'm not a prude. I just think the idea of acting is acting, so you shouldn't have to have unstimulated sex.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
The only...
Because
exception was Stranger by the Lake. I understood the reasoning for Stranger by the Lake. Was it 100% necessary? No.
Yeah, exactly. But. Like, I understood it, but I didn't think it was necessary, but I didn't mind it. I love Stranger by the Lake. I think it's very Hitchcockian. But yes. With this, I'm just like, this is literally the only frame in the movie. Like, why even have just the one frame, honestly? That's just so my opinion. It's so
funny to me. I was just like, oh, hello. Yeah. And it's like, it's in the first, like, 3 minutes. After you get this... You get, like, the title sequence. It's like, bang. And I was like, oh, shit. Antichrist, hello. And then I was like, oh, Venus, hello. There's a lot of hellos.
I also was, like, amazed. So, like, I was like, okay. Because, like, by the end of it, you see what really happened. But in the beginning, you see that the washer is going. So, it's like, okay, it makes sense they don't hear Nick opening the gate and everything. Because the washer is going, they're having sex, so there's all these noises that they're not really hearing him. But then I'm like, God, Nick has to be like, what, maybe two at the oldest? I was like, that kid's really smart to push his chair against the table. It's like that series of like steps that you would never see happen again, which obviously very sadly there has been children that have fallen to their death. Obviously Eric Clapton is the first one that comes to mind, his son. But it's still just like, it's amazing. And I know kids are smart, but it's also like, there's also just a window that happens to be open in the wintertime. Like, I'm just like, well, why?
That's weird. And also, like, at first I was really upset because there's also, like, you can tell the baby monitor is silenced. I'm like, why would ever silence your baby monitor? If your kid still needs a baby monitor, it should never be silenced. I'm sorry, I just totally clipped the mic. But I was just like, I don't like that. But yeah, and I didn't understand how we could open the baby gate if there's a lock. Also, the song that's playing, I looked up the lyrics, and then I lost them, and I looked them up again. It translates to "Let Me Weep," which is very appropriate for this movie. And it translates, it's not a very, like, it's Handel, so it's a very, like, lyrically a short song, but they just repeat a lot of them. "Let me weep over my cruel fate, and that I long for freedom." The freedom of the window? I don't know. "And that I long, and that I long for freedom. Let me weep over my cruel fate, and let me long for freedom." And it just repeats.
Yeah.
Pretty fitting for this movie.
It's really...
But sad.
You see right afterwards, so we see Nick fall to his death. In the shot, we see...
He had a harness. I was worried when I was watching. Yeah. I was like, how'd they get that shot?
It's very, like, I mean, you remember, all you have to do is see this movie one time and you instantly remember this opening scene of this child falling. But the first thing you see right after is them following the hearse with his little casket. And I'm not the first person to say this, but it really sets the tone for the movie, is that you see both parents fall. You see both parents follow the hearse, and you see he endures and she collapses. And that, well, like,
he's outwardly grieving. He's bawling his eyes out, and she has no emotion. And then she passes out.
Yeah. And it's like, he is able to endure it, and she, the grief kind of overtakes her from the beginning, which is how she ends up in the hospital for over a month. And it kind of feels like,
is it grief or guilt though?
It kind of feels like that there's this guise of maybe he's trying to help her because he's a therapist, but also he's really trying to channel his own grief, and maybe his grief is trying to fix her because of her grieving. Did read a few different things that read this movie as her suffering from postpartum depression, which I think can make a lot of sense in the context that we're given too. And that's a really interesting thing to read into.
I kind of think this movie is very much misnamed because he did think of the name before he wrote the script. Yeah. And there's not really anything about an Antichrist. There's nothing about that. She talks about, like, Satan and nature being evil, but there's nothing about an Antichrist. I kind of wish it was named, like, Eve or, like, Eden or, like, the folly of man or something. Because, like, for me, a big crux of this film and how I interpret it, because it is, like, it's about depression. But, like, honestly, everything starts getting really bad when he takes over her care because he thinks he knows better than her doctors because he's older than her. He's not a medical doctor. He's a therapist, which therapists are fantastic. I have friends who are therapists. I fucking love therapists. I've seen therapists. They're amazing people, but they're not medical doctors. And there are versions of mental illness and grief that are more physical or chemical based. And sometimes you do need medication, like if you have schizophrenia, if you have bipolar disorder, if you have a DID, like a lot of those, like, yes, you're going to see a therapist, but you're probably going to be on medication to help stabilize. Because if you're schizophrenic, it does, it's really the only way to stabilize it is medication, bipolar disorder as well, because it's an imbalance thing. So, like, he immediately, like, makes her throw away her medication. And he's like, I'm going to fix you. And he's, like, forcing her to accept him as her savior, basically. Which is not a great look. Isn't, in my opinion, a good thing. Because you're not really supposed to treat your own family.
Yeah. Well, that's what I think we said before we started filming. That the reason, because I said that this movie has nothing to do with Antichrist. But the reason it's called Antichrist is because it's the opposite of Christ-like. And that's what nature is, the opposite of Christ-like. And
which I don't really agree with personally, but I think that's his interpretation.
It's the brutality of nature. And I said brutality really weird, guys. I'm sorry. It's the brutality of nature, right. But it was because He had this idea where, you know, so many people listed, like, a place in the forest as a place of, like, peace and the closest to heaven they could be. But he's like, there's so much brutality going on in nature, like animals barely surviving, animals fighting it out to the death to survive and eat each other. So that's where, like, this whole idea is that she's afraid of the forest. And yet everyone, most people are like, yeah, you know, if they wanted to go to escape, they want to go to the forest. Which brings us into something very, very interesting, that we see that their getaway cabin is named Eden, because that doesn't have connotations, right?
We didn't want to name them Adam and Eve. I mean, come on.
But then also, I think it's really interesting because on the train, he's literally talking to her about nature. And he's like, I want you to sink into the grass. And visually, we're watching her become one with nature.
Yeah.
And it's like, there is all kinds of ramifications to that when we look at nature as being evil. Like, which is a big idea in this movie.
Which I don't, like, I don't interpret nature as evil personally. Mm-hmm. I think it can be brutal, but I think it also is just natural, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, sometimes bad things happen to me, you know? That's just how life is sometimes. But, you know, he does say it's about depression and anxiety. And so, obviously, like, in nature, and he's going to put all of that together. And I do think there, I think she, well, at first, I thought he's causing her mental illness that was present to snap, like, get worse and worse and worse, because he's like, exposure therapy is the only thing that's going to fix you, which is not true.
Yeah.
But then when you see her side towards the end of what happened, it seems like the mental illness has been there for a long time. And I guess that's why sometimes people think this movie is misogynistic. He says he actually, Lars von Trier relates more to her than him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, so I mean, I always wonder, like, why didn't he just switch the characters? Like, switch Willem Dafoe to be her side and her to be the therapist, but I don't know. Maybe I think because he just likes to make women go through more torture, frankly. But, like, you know, when you see, and this is major spoilers, I know we already said spoilers, but, like, when you see her side, first of all, you find out that she's been systematically putting her kids' shoes on the wrong feet, which, if you don't think that would deform their feet, it will. So basically, she's, like, hobbling her child. And at first, I was like, was she trying to keep him from, like, leaving her? Like, I think that was, like, the thematic reasoning was she's trying to keep him from leaving. But then she literally sees the kid jump out the window and keeps having sex, supposedly.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. So I think what it's implying is that, you know, she's doing her research on, like, women.
Gynecide.
Yeah, gynecide, thank you, that women are being killed. And rather than, like, have sympathy, she comes to the conclusion that women are inherently evil. And I think that's why there are some people who read some kind of postpartum depression analysis in this, because it's like she comes to this conclusion that they're evil, and then she starts exhibiting those signs of ill will towards her children, which usually with postpartum depression, since depression, I think, is that women fear they're going to hurt their children, and with psychosis, they sometimes do, is my understanding.
Yeah, or so they think that other people are going to hurt their children, because I know one person who had it. And she wouldn't let anyone but her and her husband touch the baby.
Yeah.
Because she was convinced they were all going to, like, kill her baby.
Which, if you happen to be a lady listener who just gave birth, please, there's no shame. It's very, very common. Please, you know, talk to somebody about it. If you are, talk to a doctor. Talk to a doctor you can trust. But do not be ashamed. Just get help for your own being. As for, like, her, we do see, so this is, like, towards the latter half of the movie, but Katie's right. We see a flashback to where she sees Nick is climbing the table, and she's still... She closes her eyes and she finishes her orgasm, right? But when you think about it, though, not saying that's right, but it makes sense what happened. So the big thing, and trigger warning, you hear this time and time again with this movie, is there's genital mutilation. I'm sorry. There's a lot of it. But it makes sense because, you know, so she believes her son's death was due to the sexual intercourse. So she... She basically takes out her rage and her grief and her anger on his genitals and her genitals.
I'm gonna say what happens. So if this is too much for you, you don't have to watch it. She takes a block of wood and hits his erect penis with it. Then she masturbates him until he ejaculates blood.
Yeah.
Which wasn't the most disturbing part, because I could kind of tell that probably was a fake dick. I hope it was a fake penis, I'm gonna be honest. And then she cuts off her own clitoris.
That hurts me both times I watched this movie. I was like, son of a bitch.
I can't say it without, like, physically cringing and, like, putting my legs together. It's awful. And there's so much blood. And there are so many nerve endings.
What's even worse is that, like, she arouses herself before she does it. So, you know, she's like making it swell before she does it. So,
but like, I understand how someone who believes that she's inherently evil, but feels contrition for what she's done, which it's like she pushed her kid out the window. There's kind of an argument if she orchestrated him dying or if she simply just neglected him, you know. It's kind of, it's a little up for interpretation if she, like, did the whole thing, because maybe she thought making him wear the shoes on the other feet would keep him from walking away. I don't know. But, like, it's, like, that kind of compulsion that she has. And, like, I did something wrong. I need to punish myself. Because, or else I'll never be forgiven. And it's like she has to do that penance. And in her eyes, that's cutting off the thing that caused her to neglect her child, which she thinks is sexual pleasure. I understand where that's coming from. I don't really need to see her actually cut her clit, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, like, I do think there is something to be said for, like, how extreme penance can be to certain people's brains when you are mentally ill. And, like, sex stuff, for some reason, with religious people, I don't get why, but they are just all up in your business about sex stuff. Yeah. And it is so ridiculous. But they do. They make you feel like normal things, like being aroused or masturbation or having sex, are evil. And it's like, you can't teach people that. But it's like this whole thing with nature being evil, you know? Like, she takes that to heart. And she takes that women are evil and women who have pleasure are evil. And she is trying to do penance for it, which she shouldn't, but there we are. And so, like, there's a lot to unpack there. But, like, I do think there is an argument for what you were saying with, like, postpartum and then also, like, this weird, scrupulosity. That's what it's called. Religious scrupulosity. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Where you, and like,
there's like even a scene I think is very telling earlier in the film where she keeps hearing Nick cry and then mm-hmm. she finds him and it's like, so she's writing in one room and she's just letting him play in another room. So it's kind of like, you know, granted, you know, like he must be two or three at the oldest. I think he's around two myself, but it's like she's just kind of doing her writing while he's in the other room, but she finds him and she still hears the crying. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very telling about her mental state, too.
Yeah.
And I did just want to touch very quickly also that we mentioned a little bit before that there's animals in the movie. So there's a deer. The deer represents grief. Mm-hmm. The fox represents pain. And the crow represents despair. And they're three beggars. And I didn't realize till the second time I watched this movie for the podcast that when Nick crawls on the table, we see statues labeled. With the same thing.
There's three beggar statues. There's also a puzzle that they knock over that are the three different kinds of animals.
Yeah.
And you see his shoes are set next to each other on the wrong side.
And
which I didn't notice until the second time I watched it and someone had pointed it out and I was like, oh.
And we see them again right after she... So they all go... It's actually kind of cute for a minute because they all go lay down. And they're like almost like cuddling together, kind of like the lion will lay down with the lamb kind of thing. There's just they're different animals and they're with each other.
And then there's Charlotte Gainsbourg's butt.
Yeah, just near her butt. But the animals look cute. But it's also like it's about to go down because that's when he strangles her to death.
Yeah. And it's a whole thing of like it's and the big question I have is like, you know, you find out that she's been doing the gynecide, what should I call it? Research. Did the research convince her that she was evil? Or is there some kind of supernatural thing going on where it is almost like Adam and Eve kind of thing? Where she's brought the quote-unquote evil and he's getting rid of the evil, which is her. Or has he now become evil? Has the evil passed on to him now?
I think I'm definitely not the first person to make this like assessment. But it's very interesting that he kills her and then he burns her because essentially she represents nature because they make again and again and again how like women are connected to nature and nature is Satan's church. And that's what they even asked.
And to quote Dwight Schrute, I wish I menstruated because then I'd be more in tune with the cycles of the moon.
Yeah, right. And they even asked Lars von Trier because they're like, well, do you think women have closer ties to nature? And he goes, I do. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, though. But it's very telling because he burns her. And it's like, and that was essentially the first time that men gained the upper hand over animals is when they learn fire. They learn how to create fire, right? So it's like, she's nature. Yeah. He burns her. And I think that's very telling that there's definitely a lot of, like, biblical stuff happening in this movie. It's just doing it under a guise, I think.
Yeah, it is, but it's also not, like, overtly religious. Yeah. And that's why, like, to me, I get the religious guilt thing because I grew up with it and I had to deal with it a lot. But, like, I think to other people, it is more, like, of a nature. And I think there's a lot of interpretations to this movie. And he purposely doesn't answer a lot except it's about depression. Like, he really, like, the film critic that is on this commentary is very much like, so what were you thinking? He's just like, it's about depression. And it's just like, okay. It's like, you know, maybe she's born with it. Maybe she's got clinical depression. That meme, I'm like, that's literally all Lars von Trier will say. And I mean, like, I don't really blame him because I think for him that is the interpretation. But I think because he had a lot of biblical and medieval source material that he was going off of, like, I think that bleeds into all of it as well. So, and I do think, I think if maybe the man was in the opposite, like, if they switched roles kind of thing, I feel like we would have a very different movie. But I'm so curious why Lars von Trier feels like she more accurately represents what he went through with his depression. But he had to make the woman be the person who lets the child die. But then a lot of people think that the man is the one that's evil. Because, I mean, he does murder her in the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like she is obviously mentally unwell.
even though she did do violence, not that he deserved all the violence, because not only does she smash his neck, but she also, like, puts a hole in his leg and puts a millstone around his leg. She tries to hobble him. So, like, I mean, like, she does do a lot of extreme stuff, but also, he shouldn't have taken her off her meds and thought he knew better. So that's why, like, I feel like the folly of man is a big part of this movie, too. Because he really started the snowball accidentally.
And this is off topic, on topic, but I would love, I'm sure you came across this. So the original ending, and I think this would have been kind of fascinating to see the lead up to this, was the original ending for this film is that it would have been revealed that God hadn't created the world, but Satan did. And that, you know, by nature, we are inherently evil. And then I guess one of his producers ended up spoiling the ending and he got mad. So he rewrote the ending. So I kind of wonder what the original draft of this movie would look like and how it came to this point with this ending, too.
I kind of liked the ending. That ending would have made more sense to me. Because honestly, I get it up until she does her penance. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to call it when she takes the scissors out. Mm-hmm. I understand it up until that point. But then, like, him killing her, either whatever evil was in her has gone out of her because she's done her penance. Or, and it's gone into him. Or he's the real evil and she was right to punish him. Not that I think, obviously this is all metaphorical. Don't hurt your spouse. Don't hurt people. I don't know. But like, it doesn't make sense that he's been kind of like stalwart and like pretty, like, and he's been enduring love and trying to love her. And even though personally, I think he made a mistake taking off her meds, he is trying to help and he does love her. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense that he's just like, I'm gonna strangle you and put you out. I guess he's putting her out of her misery and then just burn the evidence. It was kind of like a weird way to end it, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't know, because that's the thing. I don't really know the boiling point either, because it seems like, you know, like he told her he loved her and everything, and she managed to get the weight off of him before she mutilates herself. So I don't know if even seeing the three beggars had something to do with it, because the three beggars appeared to him, but then they appeared to him afterwards when he's walking through the woods too. So I don't know if that's something to do with it.
It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I really need to see if I can find the script for this one, because I'm very curious. But then I'm like, I also wonder, because like you said, he said that Charlotte and Willem made a lot of their own choices. So I wonder what may have came about naturally because of their acting choices as well.
Well, then the epilogue's kind of weird because it goes black and white and he's just walking through the woods. Oh, also, this really bothered me. The fact that like they drive to the woods, but then they have to hike like miles.
Yeah.
Just to get to their cabin. And I was like, what the fuck? Maybe it's just like that. It's supposed to be also in Washington State because they're supposed to be in Seattle, supposedly. Mm. So like, I don't understand where in Washington State, you know, there would be in that isolated cabin that wouldn't have a road like 5 miles away, you know? So weird to me. Because then, like, he has to, like, walk through woods. So then he gets on a hill and he sees the beggars. And then there are all these faceless women walking up the hill to him, like, embracing him. And I was like, I don't get it. Is it that they're embracing him, or are they going to punish him for killing his wife?
They walk past him, though. Because that's something both times. Because both times I was, like, flinching. Dead? Because I'm like, do they grab him? Do they, like, harm him? But they walk past him. But there's so many of them, you lose him in the sea of them. And so why is their faces blurred?
Yeah, everyone's face is blurred except for, like, in the funeral sequence, too, everyone's face is blurred.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, a stylistic choice to keep only Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg from, like, to be the focus. But it's so weird. I don't know. I can't figure out if he's dead in seeing different spirits of women that have been murdered by men, or
is it also symbolic that he's like left Eden too, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, that's a lot of women. Like, there's not, like, just those many people walking in the woods, you know?
Yeah.
So, for me, I'm like, I feel like, because he also walks past a bunch of dead bodies that weren't there originally. So, like, yeah. I don't know. It's weird. I don't really understand the epilogue. And a lot of people, like, don't count the epilogue as part of the movie in their interpretations. They're like, he's just there. And there's all these, like, women that don't have faces.
When I first watched this movie for the first time, like 10 years ago, it may have been like 9 or 10 years ago, I thought that maybe it was that she, it, you know, because she was studying witches, I thought maybe they were witches that came out of the woods, and maybe it was like there was something supernatural going on at the cabin. But now it's like, I don't know if I buy that. I don't really know what they're supposed to symbolize. It's definitely something symbolic is going on. I'm just not quite sure what it is.
It's weird because it's almost like he's walking out of Eden, but like he hasn't quite reached like civilization yet.
Yeah.
Also, did you know that like for the sound engineer like swallowed a microphone?
I did read that.
So he could get the right like sound? I was like, interesting. I don't really know where those sounds came into place, but okay. Yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else that we need to go through that, like, stood out to you? I feel like we've talked about the most controversial parts.
No, I think that's pretty much most of it for me. Yeah. That's touching all the main things for me anyway.
So, are you more of, like, did you like it or did you hate it?
I'll be honest. This is one of those movies I really like the symbolism in it. I really like the analysis. I've said it before on the podcast. I'll probably say it again. I do like movies that read more like literature just because I enjoy literature. I enjoy analyzing things. Overall, though, it's not really my favorite movie. It's not one that I would seek out to watch again and again. I can't say I like it. I think it's interesting, is what I'll say.
You know, I wouldn't even call this, you know, everyone always says it's a horror movie, and there is horrific violence in it, which I think is why they put it in a horror movie. It's kind of like Parasite is not a horror film, but because there is violence in it, and there's a lot of blood at one part in it, people are like, oh, it's a horror movie, but it's not. It's really more of a, like a psychological drama or horror. But really, like, the violence kind of pushed it out of me finding it interesting. Because it is a lot of violence that does have symbolism, but we don't necessarily need to see it to get the point across.
Yeah.
And that's not really his style. He doesn't like giving people a break when there's violence on screen. He enjoys it, and he says it's part of his dark humor. So, like, you know, that's just kind of Lars von Trier. Something bad is going to happen, and you're going to have to watch it in his movies. So, like, I don't know. It's one of those movies where, like, I'm glad I finally saw it. It's not as disturbing as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really, like, scary. It didn't creep me out. I didn't have nightmares after watching it. But the violence sat with me. And I definitely sat there and was just like, wow, what the fuck was that? But there is a lot to talk about, and it did, like, bring up some interesting things. So I can't say it's a waste of a film. And Charlotte Gainsbourg, I do think she deserved the Best Actress Palm, or award, whatever they call it when they do it. Which she's actually directed three actresses to get that. Bjork, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and Kirsten Dunst have all gotten the Best Actress for one of his films. Which is great.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, for me as an actor, I'd be like, that's great. I don't think the movie is brilliant enough to be worth all that headache and mental anguish. And I think that's the thing that bothers me about him, is because I do think he doesn't. It doesn't seem like he treats his actors super well. I feel like I'm a person who has a very high tolerance for physical brutality. And I didn't like this. I didn't like that part.
This is definitely a very triggering movie. Once again, we're dealing with child death. We're dealing with animal violence. Yes. We're dealing with genital mutilation.
Yes.
So this is not one I could easily recommend to probably anyone I know, if I'm being honest.
I think if you really like to analyze films, absolutely watch this movie. But maybe fast forward through the genital mutilation, because it's not really... So, anyways, did you have a out of 10 rating for it?
I did. So, I actually gave this one a 6 out of 10. Because, once again, I thought some of the analysis in it is really kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I like that. for me, there's not really a rewatchability factor. I don't know who would want to watch this movie more than twice, maybe. Thought the acting was great. Acting was great all around. There's some really beautiful cinematography in it. It's just not my movie, if I'm being honest.
No. I would have thought this would be my movie. It's not. I got a 6.5.
Oh, wow. You still got higher than me, though. That's a little bit surprising.
Only because it's, like, I do think that it is a movie. It's on the Criterion Collection for a reason. I think it does represent a moment in filmmaking that was very historical. And I think the filmmaking itself is good. I just think the genital mutilation knocks it down several pegs. And I don't think it will be one that I'll be watching again. I feel like it was like Dogtooth for me again. Like, it was just like, oh, that was a lot.
Yeah.
That was a lot. And it's like, it takes a long time to get to it. But when it does, you're like, ah, that's a lot. It's a lot of stuff that is unnecessary. Did you have a Grindhouse Girls rating for it?
I did. So I have to give Taylor, because Taylor actually did a Grindhouse Girls rating too.
Oh.
So I rated it T for triangles, ticks, and therapists. Mm. Taylor rated it S for sex, scissors, and Satan's church.
I had it rated G for grief, gynecide, and genital mutilation.
Oh, yeah. That pretty much sums up the movie, so yeah.
Yeah. Which one do we like better?
I think I like G, because we also don't really ever have too many Gs. We don't have a lot of Gs or Ts, I think, but we'll do G, because we have even less G.
Okay. Disclaimer, it's not actually rated G. Do not show children this movie.
Yeah. Oh, God, no. Please, God. Please, God, no.
Do not show children this movie.
That's Antichrist, so.
Yeah, I'm glad it got checked off the list.
Yeah.
Whew. But next time, we're going to be celebrating our anniversary episode for this year.
Are we six? On four years?
Five, I think.
Five
or six.
Five? I thought 2020 was our first year, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So fourth year.
Fourth year. Okay. Yeah.
Fifth season, fourth year. You're right.
Fifth season, fourth year. Okay.
Yeah. It's the season thing. But, like, next week, we're going to have a special video treat.
Yay!
For everybody. So, Ryan and our Moody, our lovely, lovely, lovely editor, was part of the Kickstarter campaign for Terrorscape, which is a board game. And basically, it says, on a stormy night, a couple of unfortunate travelers rushed into an abandoned mansion in the woods to take shelter. But even worse than the merciless rain, they have, in fact, accidentally entered into the hunting ground of a bloodthirsty killer. So basically, we're going to be trying to escape a killer.
Woo!
And play a game. So it'll be really fun. And we're going to tape it and release it on YouTube and shit, so it'll be super, super, super fun. But so keep an eye out for that. I guess, like, we could try to, like, release the audio part of it too.
Yeah.
For the podcast, I guess the plan too. But it's gonna be like probably like a longer episode than normal and something kind of fun to celebrate. And then I think we're doing another special episode.
Yeah, we are. So stay tuned for more details on that. But we should be doing a special episode shortly after that episode, so it'll be a week or 2 weeks after our anniversary episode, but we will make an announcement when we know for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so we'll see you guys for our special episode next time. We love y'all. Thank you for listening for 4 years. It's amazing. You guys are great, and thanks for enduring this movie. I'm sorry. I hope you guys had a good Easter if you celebrate, and spring is here. So take care of those allergies. Hopefully you don't sound like me with your nose all stuffed up. But we love you guys. Take care of yourselves. And thanks for listening. Wash your hands. And yeah, I can't think of anything else to say. So I'm going to let Britt take over.
Spay and neuter your pets. I'll say that every week. Like the late, great Bob Barker. For my animal-loving folks, particularly in our area, you guys know we're in Alabama. One of our local shelters to us, Shelby County Humane, is having a low-cost vaccine and microchip clinic. So if you guys need some low-cost healthcare for those fur kiddos, So, guys, that will be Sunday, April 14th. It's going to be happening at Pelham Pulse in the Park. So, I've decided that because we do have a few friends in the area, I'm going to try to kind of find things local. And especially if it's related to theater and film, we're trying to keep an eye out more for sidewalk film. I think the Grindhouse Girl cast and crew is going to try to do more sidewalk film festival things because we are relatively close to there. Let us know what's happening in our community, if you're local to our community. If you're not local to our community, tell us what's happening in your community. That would maybe be cool for us to come out and see you guys. Because we do have friends kind of slowly. We're gathering people a little bit here and there all over the U.S., which I think is pretty cool. So thank you, guys. Yeah. So, yeah, let us know what's going on in your life. Let us know if there's any events coming up that we are looking forward to, that you think we would look forward to, or you think our listeners like yourselves would look forward to. Thank you guys for always listening. Take care of yourselves and one another, and we just look forward to seeing you next time. Same spoopy time, same spoopy channel.
Stay spoopy, y'all. Spoopy, y'all.
Bye. Have a good night. Stay safe, Katie.
You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
The Grindhouse Girls podcast is a production by Katie Dale and Britt Ray. Our editor is N.R. Moody. All music used is royalty-free and can be found in our annotations. You can follow us on all of our socials. And if you have any comments, questions, or just want to say hey, our email is contactus@grindhousegirlspod.com. Thanks for listening.